This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A new study out from researchers at the University of Hawaii at Hilo looks at suicide in the U.S. Army over two centuries. It challenges the assumption that combat is the primary driver of suicide in the active duty force. This morning, we talked to Jeff Smith, lead author of the just-released report. What got you interested in doing this?
It's an outgrowth of some work that I had previously done with Professor Free in the psychology department here at UH Hilo. We both share an interest in military history, and so when I first came on board, I was talking with him just kind of in passing, and we basically had our conversations build up to a article that we did on the U.S. Civil War, comparing suicide, alcoholism, and psychiatric illness there with a little bit of what we were seeing at the time in the U.S. military, and that was in 2012. And that garnered a fair amount of media attention and some follow-up pieces, and so it did kind of well for itself, and we figured that it would be great to kind of do something bigger than that, and that was kind of the genesis of where this all came from.
So you look at records from 1819 to 2017. That's a huge span of time.
That is. Basically, we were trying to approach it from the standpoint of that a lot of current research tends to focus on, say, the last 10 or 20 years. And so instead of looking at it from the perspective of just one or two decades, what if you did it from the perspective of two centuries, right? Would that kind of reframe the question here for us?
And so what's the takeaway?
The takeaway is a couple of things. One, that it's impossible to solve a problem until you can understand the history of it. Historical knowledge of a problem shapes how society approaches it, the questions you ask, and then, of course, where you look for answers. Because the other part to it, that perhaps the more technical or direct impact, is that when you reframe this question of military suicide in the U.S. Army from the perspective of 200 years, you notice what appears to be a pattern of decreasing rates during active combat, and that was fairly consistent until about the mid-20th century, when you start seeing the so-called endless wars in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and that's where you start to notice an actual increase in suicide during active combat. Thus, we are advocating for looking for factors possibly beyond the battlefield, and that looking at combat as a singular driver of suicide might not be the best way to approach the current situation.
So if you have this pattern in suicide rates, what does it say about, post-traumatic stress syndrome?
I think when you're looking at some of those other factors beyond suicide, like you mentioned with like PTSD, again, that while combat and combat exposure can play a role, I think sometimes, and understandably so, there seems to be a singular fixation on combat exposure being the primary driver. And from a historical standpoint, that doesn't necessarily seem to be the case, at least in respect to suicide. So even with something like PTSD, it's probably more so a multifactorial problem, and thus, socioeconomic factors, psychological factors should probably be looked into and stressed a little bit more firmly than just simply combat alone.
And this study, I'm sure, will probably get lots of eyes on it, given we had that situation of the shooting at Pearl Harbor recently, and there's still a lot of, questions remaining about the motive and the shooter's state of mind.
Absolutely. And I really can't comment on the specifics of the Pearl Harbor incident. It's a tragedy, of course, but not a lot of information is out there right now, as you mentioned. But from our perspective in moving forward and trying to avert further tragedies, we would advocate for perhaps a more holistic approach, and one that incorporates more causes and factors than a lot of times gets boiled down to simply exposure to combat. Ideally, more funding in this type of research would be crucial, but it should be noted that the current study that was published in JAMA was basically taken 100% from publicly available data. We didn't have special access or special software or some sort of grant funding. This was something that we did on our own. And so moving forward to look at further demographic issues would probably require some additional funding and, you know, probably additional access to data. We're hopefully trying to line that up if we can.
Any reaction from the Department of Defense on this?
Not yet. Hopefully, in the near future, we'll be able to discuss it with them. It just came out this past Friday afternoon, and so it's Monday morning now. So I think they're still kind of digesting it, and we look forward to working with them, though, if possible. I just think it's a national tragedy, and it's something that is increasingly affecting and touching more people's lives, and that when we, you know, as a society in general, we don't talk about suicide because we don't like to talk about suicide. But when you kind of broach these conversations with folks, I think a larger pattern starts to emerge that everybody's been touched by this in one way or another. And so anything that we could do to possibly help get a better handle on it was something that we felt was time well spent.
Is there anything else just about getting beyond the stigma that folks who might need help are reluctant to get help because it might affect their military service?
Being able to, I think, discuss this in the open and be able to discuss it from a historic standpoint to put it into a broader context is hopefully another way to break down some of that stigma that surrounds suicide and sometimes inhibits people from wanting to reach out and seek help, to know that they're, of course, not alone and that these patterns have persisted over time can hopefully at least motivate a couple of people to do so.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
That was Jeff Smith, associate professor at UH Hilo. He was talking about a study that was published in the Journal of American Medical Association. Other co-authors of the report, which looked at suicide in the Army, include clinical psychologist and professor Chris Few, Michael Deutsch with the DoD Health Agency, and senior Ryan Hanoa, a history major. To find links to the study, go to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Maui Arts and Cultural Center. Folk and pop music group The Kingston Trio celebrate their 60th anniversary tour, 7:30 p.m. this Friday, in the McCoy Studio Theater, mauiarts.org.
Depletion, abundance, joy, despair, fire, water, what truly separates them? Are they really that far apart? Hawaii Arts Lab will explore these ideas in Yin and Yang, a varied vocal performance on Saturday, January 4th in HPR's Atherton Studio. The multidisciplinary show will feature classical voice and instrumentation, and a few surprises, too. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Highway Inn Hawaiian Food and Catering, launching its new Waipahu location December 30th on Molowalo Street along Farrington Highway, a few blocks from its beginning 72 years ago. MyHighwayInn.com.
A recent audit of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs looked into 185 transactions conducted between 2012 and 2016. In some cases, it couldn't find documentation that work it contracted for was actually produced. OHA Chair Colette Machado said the board has instituted tighter controls, including hiring new CEO Sylvia Hussey. OHA trustee Kele'i Akina called for the audit and has been very vocal about his criticism, enough so that the board took action, saying he went against OHA's code of conduct. It's something that quite hasn't been cleared up yet, and Akina believes it's his responsibility to speak up, even if it isn't in step with the full board.
Well, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs has a code of conduct that some have interpreted to mean that a trustee cannot speak out and disagree with the board after an action has been taken. Now, that's not a very good thing because trustees are public officials. They're elected to office to represent the people and to represent ideas. And our First Amendment guarantees that. of all places in our government, we should allow our officials to exercise First Amendment. That's the one way that they can stand up and ideas can compete against each other.
Right. And the board has this still hanging overhead, that they have this permitted interactive group that can meet, but it's still kind of a gray area at this point.
Well, the Board of Trustees of OHA used a tool called Permitted Interaction Group, which allows some trustees to meet privately and take care of a matter outside of the view of the public. And a PIG was formed, a PIG, in order to look into the complaint that I had been unloyal in my comments. And it was a process that had many problems with it. First of all, they came to a judgment and said that I had spoken in a way that wasn't truthful. And they concluded, however, that there's nothing they could do to me, that there was no discipline they could bring upon me. But the problem is they made that finding known publicly. And number one, they had never interviewed me. They'd never asked me to give my point of view. And number two, they had never told me what specifically I had said, actually, what statement in particular I'd made that wasn't true. And yet here this committee made a judgment and went public. Now, my concern is that that could cause a lot of public officials and potentially some other trustees not to speak out.
Right, it could have a chilling effect.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, a chilling effect on free speech. And it's so important for each individual trustee to be able to speak out and to represent the beneficiaries.
Now, one of the things that you have been a champion of is more transparency.
That's the irony of all of this. I had actually criticized the pace at which we were completing the audit. The board had actually authorized the expenditure for this audit back in 2017. And by midway through 2019, it still wasn't done. That's a lot of time. And during that time, a lot of things can happen. Documents can disappear, staff can leave, and so forth. The quality of the audit could be affected. Well, I was critical of that, and I went public about that. And I really believed that the board should have done more in the whole process to ensure that that audit got done in a timely way and without any interference. And so the irony is that we're looking at these audit results which have just come out recently, and these are all from the audit that I was concerned about.
Right, and those very things were flagged, that a number of staff, you know, have left, and so there are certain things that they couldn't follow up with.
The recent audit findings took a look at 185 different contracts and financial disbursements that OHA conducted between July 2012 and June 2016. And when they looked at all of those transactions, the 185, they found that 153 of them had what we call audit observations, or 85% of them. Those were concerns that were raised by the auditors that there could be issues with compliance or with red flags of waste, fraud, or abuse. I'm particularly concerned about 32 of them, or 17% of the audit sampling, that showed red flags for fraud, waste, and abuse. That's a fairly high amount. And the important thing is that we really have to take a look into these findings and see what was going on during that period of time.
And I know a couple of the board members have released a statement about the fact that while there were some areas that were flagged by this audit, they were saying that there weren't specific things that were brought to their attention.
The auditors brought a great deal of detail to the attention of the board. They made it clear, however, and this is the case, that they were not the ones to determine whether there was fraud or any criminality, because that wasn't their function. They weren't a criminal.
Your auditors.
That's right. What they could do, however, is give indicators. And it's so important to take a look at those indicators and see what was going on.
The board now will take this up, I guess, in January. Now that they've got this information, folks are trying to digest it and figure out, okay, what are the areas where we need to tighten up on, you know, what are the steps that need to be taken to ensure that we don't have these areas where it's a little suspect?
That's right. The auditors identified 32 specific contracts and disbursements as what they called red flags, or transactions with indicators of potential fraud, waste, and abuse. That totals to $7.8 million. And so one of the things I did was put a report together that helped the board to understand what these issues were. The actual document of the audit is 1,100 pages. That's huge. But I produced a smaller report called Red Flags, an analysis of the independent audit of OHA and its LLCs, in order to take a look at each of these 32 cases. And when we look at them, we see things that really should raise a red flag, because they show that during that period of time of 2012 to 2016, there was a lot of irregularity. And it suggests that there could be fraud, waste, or abuse.
And the concern with these LLCs is that it would then provide another filter. It would kind of shield information from the general public about what may have been going on with these companies.
Well, the audit took a look at both the OHA organization at large and its subsidiary companies called LLCs. And this was a very small sampling, however, of the LLCs, so it didn't really go very much into depth or look at most of their transactions, but it did show that there were some irregularities. The Office of Hawaiian Affairs is a public agency, and it's accountable to the general public as well as to the Hawaiian beneficiaries. It's got to be transparent. It's got to show where its money comes from and where it's going, and it has to account for every single dollar. What this recent audit shows is that there is a lot of that money that wasn't accounted for. A great deal of it has no documentation in order to show where the money went. For example, there's one contract for $2.6 million that went to an organization that helped the Office of Hawaiian Affairs to fund a Native Hawaiian election. The auditors tell us that they couldn't find basic documentation to show that all the products were delivered. And that's very serious if you can't really account for the money that goes in and is used supposedly to help the Hawaiian people.
Right, there's no paper trail to back up that it was done properly.
Right. Other examples indicate that OHA potentially misappropriated trust funds for profit businesses. And that's very egregious. In one case, OHA provided a $150,000 lease guarantee to a private firm when it defaulted on its commercial lease of property located at the Waikiki Beach Walk. And similarly, through a series of four disbursements, OHA diverted $118,000 to a for-profit entity that is currently operating a private business on Kauai. This raises a lot of questions, as well as legal questions as well. So the audit is filled with this kind of information, and the most important thing now is for beneficiaries and the public to call upon OHA to look into these matters. I do want to say that much improvement has taken place in the Office of Hawaiian Affairs since I became a trustee in 2016. In fact, the mere fact that this audit was taking place, I believe, motivated the organization to perform even more tightly in terms of procurement, in terms of finances, and so forth. So I do want to commend the organization. I don't want to say that it's going in the wrong direction at all. But there's a lot more to do. And this audit, which looked at 2012 to 2016 in a very deep way, needs to be paid attention to, because we still have to answer the question, why did all of these things happen? You know, and who's responsible for that? And we have to hold people accountable. I'm very pleased with the new CEO that the board of directors has selected, and I feel that the process by which she was selected was a very fair one. It was competitive. It was one that did not allow trustees to intervene, and I think we've chosen someone very good who's able to help us to improve the quality of accountability at OHA. Some people ask why I'm so concerned about auditing OHA, and it's simply for this reason. There are Hawaiians who need housing and jobs and education and health care. And every dollar matters. That's why we have to take a look at OHA very carefully. In some cases, I think OHA really needs a watchdog, and that's one of the roles that we as trustees need to play.
That was OHA trustee Kaylee Akina talking about a recent audit of OHA. Now, there is still a second audit pending, one ordered by state lawmakers tied to funding. The legislative auditor is looking into the state agency's LLCs, something that Akina believes is being used to shield outside eyes from what's really going on. That audit by state auditor Les Kondo is expected before the start of the legislative session next month.
Thank you.
Reality Check with our partners Honolulu Civil Beat continues the deep dive on adoptions in Micronesia. Editor John Hale has been on top of the twists and turns on the crackdown of illegal adoptions in the Marshalls. Good morning.
Hi, Catherine.
So tell us, what's the latest development in this black market scam?
Well, we had already reported about a Honolulu attorney, Lori Loomis, who we showed was bringing women from the Marshall Islands or arranging adoptions that involved women traveling to the U.S. from the Marshall Islands, which the Marshall Islands and the U.S. State Department say should not be done according to the law. So we've already reported that. What we reported today was that these birth mothers from the Marshall Islands were lined up by the Honolulu attorney, but she relied on a what's called an adoption consultant in Georgia to find the adoptive parents for these children. And what we were able to show from emails and other correspondence that was shared with us is that the adoption consultant in Atlanta was aware that the women were coming from them, or I can't say that they were aware, but that the materials they forwarded contained clear information that the women were traveling to the U.S. Contrary to the treaty between the two nations.
And the whole, I guess, the question is, did someone know that they were pregnant and planning to give birth here, right?
Yeah, I mean, clearly the attorney, Lori Loomis, knew that and when she arranged these adoptions. And these emails pretty clearly show that if the consultant had wanted to know, all they had to do was read the materials they were forwarding.
Now, this investigation took place over, several states because these adoptions were just taking place, you know, all over.
Yeah. In fact, there's one attorney. We did a series of, it was published more than a year ago now, about several attorneys who would arrange these adoptions from the Marshall Islands. Now, the way it's supposed to happen is that the Marshall Islands set up a process where if you're going to do an international adoption, they want you to go through a government agency there. They require you to go through a government agency in the Marshall Islands. And that was set up to stop the abuses that were happening in international adoptions about two decades ago, where the Marshall Islands became, for reasons that are a little bit obscure, became a real pipeline for international adoptions. So they set up this government agency, but we showed that there's these lawyers in the U.S. who bypass that whole official thing and bypass the law and bring women here for adoptions. One of them was an Arizona attorney named Paul Peterson. He's now been indicted in three states on a number of different federal and state charges. He faces, I think, more than 350 years in prison if he were convicted of all these charges for what he was doing. And there have been some actions against some of the other attorneys, but that's been the main thing so far.
Okay, and so what's happening here locally with Loomis?
Well, we wrote a story saying that the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, which polices lawyers in Honolulu, it's a division of the state Supreme Court, is investigating her. And that's what we know about that. As far as some actions have been taken against some of the other lawyers. We wrote about one in Texas. She had her international adoption certification revoked like a short time after we wrote the story about her. So it's years of inaction on these Marshallese adoptions. And now all of a sudden this year, a lot of things have started happening kind of all over the place.
And so have you had a chance to hear from Loomis?
She gave us a statement saying that she has complied with diligently with all applicable laws, but she didn't want to actually have a conversation about it because she said, adoptions are private and it would be improper for her to discuss individual cases.
And so these adoptions now, do the parents have any say in who gets their child?
Well, that's one of the things we looked at with this adoption consultant, this one in Georgia. They're called Faithful Adoption Consultants, and they are a Christian-based service, and they describe themselves as being pro-life, and they place a big emphasis. I found a speech online in which one of the founders of this consultancy was talking about how important it is for birth mothers to be able to choose the adoptive parents of their child. But I found at least one case in which one of these adoptions that they arranged through Lori Loomis, the birth mother did not choose the adoptive parents. They kind of compared notes afterwards, the birth mother and the adoptive parents, and realized that she had not chosen them at all. The choice had been made by the attorney.
And so these black market adoptions, gosh, I mean, I know that, you know, culturally there is just this a difference in understanding, you know, what an adoption is, that you won't see your child after that. You give up all your rights. Any more on that?
Well, that's really true. And that's something that is, I when I first got into this, I kind of didn't fully understand what a big deal that is, that there's a long history, tradition in the Marshall Islands of informal child sharing, where a child may go off for a few years with relatives or friends and then come back. But there's not a tradition of going into a courtroom and signing a piece of paper and never seeing your child again. So there's a lot of misunderstanding, and I don't know exactly why it happens, whether they're being told things that are not correct, or it's just this whole mythology has built up that the children will return to them at the age of 18, or that they'll be able to see them. And so many of them are in open adoptions, but it's not guaranteed.
Yeah, a disconnect there. But thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Editor John Hill with today's Reality Check. Head to civilbeat.org to read this latest story and previous coverage of the issue that's caught the attention of investigators.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Airlines, celebrating 90 years, offering more than 170 flights a day between the neighbor islands. Reservations at hawaiianairlines.com.
This morning, HPR's Kuve Hirishi joins us to talk about a new approach to health in Waimanalo.
That's right, Catherine. Good morning. Looking at this intervention of aquaponics, basically, and I know you're a big aquaponics fan yourself, but specifically for Native Hawaiians living in Waimanalo, this was the hypothesis for this study, is to look at whether or not having a backyard aquaponics system will improve health outcomes. So actually looking at clinical data on this. So for Waimanalo, Ilimoho Lastimosa, sort of the aquaponics champion over there in Waimanalo, has been doing backyard aquaponics for homesteaders, but also for Native Hawaiians in Waimanalo for more than a decade. She's been a big advocate for it, but they've never really designed a study that would look at the actual healthcare outcomes, so cholesterol or BMI, body mass index, things that are actually changing in the body. They've taken a lot of sort of focus groups and surveys from participants saying, yes, I feel better, or I have more access to food, fresh food, but no clinical studies. So she's teamed up with Jane Chung Do. She's an associate professor over at UH Manoa in the Office of Public Health Studies, to design a study that would look for exactly that. So here's Chung Do to kind of explain her hypothesis with what she hopes will come out of this.
I hope that it will say what we've been hearing for the past decade of Ilima doing this in Waimanalo, which is it's enhancing people's relationship with their families, their community, that sense of connectedness that's related to everything. So there's a lot of studies that show that feelings of connectedness is related to obesity, to mental health, to has so many impacts for diseases and health outcomes. So that's what I think definitely will increase, or we'll see a change in, or some kind of transformation in. It's not just people reporting, oh, I feel good because I feel connected to my family and my community, and I feel like I'm eating more vegetables and fruit. We can see some clinical impacts.
So I got to speak to some of the participants in the second cohort. This is a 3-year study that these folks are doing over in Waimanalo. And Shelly Ortiz, who decided to participate in this program, she is a longtime Waimanalo a resident, but she also works in a very high-stress job as an EMT for the city and county. And so when she decided to participate, she's not quite 40 years old yet, but she's been noticing that in her family, she's got a high risk for diabetes, high blood pressure, and cancer, which has been prevalent in her ohana. And so she kind of took this step to prevent some of that from happening, or hope to prevent some of that from happening. So here's Ortiz talking about why she decided to participate.
My focus recently in my life as a whole for balance has been trying to, I have this mentality in my head about putting my toes in the dirt, just to get reconnected with the Aina. And it makes me feel better. I generally have a high stress job. So how do you release that stress? What's the turnover? Yeah. And, you know, I enjoy being in my yard and doing work, and having tangible things that will turn around and feed us is just such a great idea.
So part of what the study is going to do is follow folks like Ortiz throughout these 3 years, take in clinical data when they can, and see if it is in fact going to improve their health if they have this access to fresh food in their backyards.
So you talk about this being the second cohort. So what were the results of the first one?
The first, they don't have those because they haven't gone through the 3 years.
Oh, gotcha.
But
okay.
The preliminary data that has been taken have shown, yeah, some small increases or decreases wherever it was needed. But we won't know, and I think this is part of what Cheng Do was explaining, that when it comes to healthcare outcomes, it needs to happen over a long period of time for them to really have some strong data to support their hypothesis. I think we were speaking about other sorts of similar studies that are being done by, I think it's Alika Mauna Kea over at UH's medical school, working with those at Ma'o Organic Farms in Waianae to see if there was a correlation between working there at Ma'o Farms and a risk for diabetes, I believe was his hypothesis.
Yeah, and I think his first round of results of data shows, that it's working, and they're really encouraged by that.
Right, and I think to Cheng Do's credit, she hopes that that will be the same sort of result that they have here when you have. So part of the study wasn't just to give them a backyard aquaponics system, but it was for everyone to go through this crash course in aquaponics so that they can build their own system alongside others from their community, and finding out if this community connectedness, if going through this process with your neighbor helps improve your outcomes in any way. I mean, it was funny when I went to go see Shelley Ortiz over in Kumuhau Hawaiian Homestead. She, after our interview, had said, "Oh, no, somebody else in the cohort lives just two houses down. We'll go interview her. Come with me." And we went over, just yelling her name. And, you know, this idea of having accountability with your neighbors to improve your health through this mechanism will be interesting to see the results of.
Yeah, because I'm wondering now, how different it is from what Alika does with his epigenetics, which was a new term for me, which is interesting. And his whole thing was that will it hopefully improve relationships, not just within the family, because they're talking more about health and healthier things to eat. But, you know, there are all the tests, right? You get the blood tests, you get the cholesterol workup and all of that. So they track you.
They do. And I think that this community cohesion part of that is really helping them, you know, show up for all these clinical tests or make sure that they're keeping their aquaponic system going. But in talking about sort of the long-term impacts of studies like these in the research field or the research realm, Cheng Do says this is sort of going back in a way in terms of indigenous understanding of holistic health when it comes to knowing that, okay, if I'm close with my family, that's going to help my healthcare outcomes. So this is Cheng Do sort of talking about the future, I guess, of this study.
I think communities have known it for a long time, right? Especially indigenous communities. This is the way people look at health and life and wellness and communities. But I think Western science or academics are now catching up. So you see more publications that talk about these things and are reporting the potential of really paying attention to culture, not as just like a touchy-feely thing. It's like so integral to health. Right? Health is relational, health is cultural, and I think Western researchers are finally catching up to that.
So it'll be interesting to see the results of this and whether or not they'll seek funding to continue it longer term than the 3 years.
Now, this is in Waimanalo, but is it on Waimanalo homestead land?
No, it's not specific. It hasn't been limited to homestead land, but the roots of the aquaponics movement in Waimanalo has been on homestead land, and many of the participants are on homestead land, but it hasn't been limited to them. And mainly, it has been limited to Native Hawaiians. So we do know Waimanalo, very close-knit community, but also a strong presence of Native Hawaiian families who are also, it's a very rural area. So the idea of getting to a farmer's market when you're working your two or three jobs, depending on what the socioeconomic portion of that is, those are some of the challenges and the reasons why this study sort of came about, was to provide that access there in Waimanalo.
And there is Waimanalo Feed, which is, you know,
right, right around the corner.
Aquaponic Central, right? And they have whole kits that you know, help
exactly.
people. And they can set it up very easily.
Exactly. Yeah, you know a thing or two about this. That is, I think there's a lot of some strong roots for aquaponics there in Waimanalo, but the vision, at least from Ilimaho Lastimosa's point of view, is that these backyard aquaponic systems can be in everyone's backyard to improve everyone's health.
Right. So, yeah, it doesn't take a lot.
Exactly.
All right, but thanks so much.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been talking with HPR's Ku'uwehi Hiraishi. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. This week, astronomer Christopher Phillips joins HPR's Dave Lawrence. The scientific community celebrates the Newton X-ray Space Telescope, 2 decades of discovery and exploration of the vast cosmic universe.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, and also things we can try and spot in our dark skies. Astronomer Christopher Phillips joining us again. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do we have in store this week?
Hey, Dave, good to be here. So this week, stargazers, Saturn can be found in the west after sunset till it sets around 8 p.m. The moon this week is passing through its last quarter phase in perfect conditions for stargazing.
You have an anniversary of sorts?
Yes. We celebrate a cosmic milestone in the mission of the Newton X-ray Space Telescope as it passes its 20th year in operation. Now, we don't often hear much about the Newton Telescope, and that's probably because of the highly specialized nature of its mission, to explore the universe as it appears in the X-ray part of the spectrum. Being able to view the universe in X-rays means we can effectively see the invisible and discover wonders in the universe that would otherwise remain hidden from us.
Sounds like a science fiction movie or something.
It is. And wait until you get a load of the discoveries. Newton has revealed a cosmic treasure trove, including galaxy clusters, stellar outbursts, supernovae, and most importantly, black holes. And it's in the area of black hole study that Newton has outshone every other space telescope.
Who runs this thing anyway?
Newton is actually run by the European Space Agency.
Ah, look at you guys over there, huh? And so tell us a little bit more about the X-ray astronomy technology, which is something that can only be done from space, right?
Indeed. It is possible to conduct some very limited X-ray observations from the Earth, but to do X-ray astronomy properly, one must go into space, above the atmosphere that prevents us from seeing the X-ray universe from the ground. If you're able to see the universe as Newton can by, say, putting on a pair of X-ray specs, the sky would appear to be ablaze with bright X-ray sources in every direction.
Hey, we should market something like that.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Turn everybody onto the universe, too.
You could tune into the cosmos.
And is Newton set to continue this exciting and provocative mission?
It certainly is. 20 years in space has not slowed this intrepid explorer down one bit, and Newton will continue to explore the universe for years to come.
Perhaps we'll even hear about it on a future Stargazer here with Christopher Phillips. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer in the meantime at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
The Kingston Trio has a long list of hits, and this year the band marks 60 years and is heading to Honolulu to perform. You may remember that two of the original musicians had Hawaii ties. We talked to Mike Marvin, one of the current members of the band. He tells us Dave Garg went to Punahou, and Bob Shane, he says, went to Roosevelt.
We're calling it Keeping the Music Alive Tour, and boy, it's been that every inch of the way. It's been really fun, and people have really responded. I mean, it's been incredible. It seems like everywhere we go, it's like incredibly, there's almost a festival excitement when you get there. And then we've been selling out just about every show, and it's been just an incredible experience. You just see how happy everybody is to hear the songs and music. I mean, it's really something to see. I've been really impressed by these audiences.
Well, I just went back and listened to some things on YouTube, and I just remembered as a kid listening to Lemon Tree.
When we start the show, I always let the audience know that, you know, welcome aboard our time machine, sort of, because it really is, in a way, just that. It's really surprising at the end, because afterwards we always go out after the show and say hello to everybody. And it's really, you can really see it in people's faces and in their eyes. It's that they've had a great time. And a lot of times people come up to me and say, you know, for this evening, I was 19 years old again. Or you know, this remind me, right? One woman came up to me about a week ago and said, this reminds me of the evening I met my husband. And things like that happen all the time. It's just been really fun for that reason.
And talk about your connection to the original members.
Well, Nick Reynolds, who was one of the founding members with Shane and Gard, he was from San Diego. He was my cousin. And when I was a teenager, I moved in with him. And so I was there at the heyday of the Kingston Trio, when it was, you know, when they were the biggest act in the world at the time. For about 5 or 6 years, they were the biggest act in the world until the Beatles came along. And he took me in, and I learned the song. He taught me the songs, and he taught me how the trio picked their songs, why they picked their songs. And over the course of several years, I really was immersed in everything that the trio did and was about, and so I really sort of had a tutorial in folk music as viewed by the Kingston Trio. It was really an experience, I must say.
So, no, I have many favorites. What are yours?
I have about 3 or 4. One of the favorites we do in the concert. Well, we do all my favorites in the concert.
Of course.
I like the sinking of the Reuben James. Mm. Where Have All the Flowers Gone is always one of my favorites, believe it or not. And let's see. I like Hobo's Lullaby, which wasn't a big famous song, but I like all the Calypso songs, too. You know, I think there's a saying out there floating around. It says, the Kingston Trio, a Hawaiian Calypso band that saved country music. I've always thought that was kind of funny.
you know, it's an opportunity, I guess, as you go across the country to also kind of expose a whole new generation to this music if they're not familiar with it.
That is true. Every now and then, well, more and more we're seeing a younger audience than what I just call our white-haired audience. There are younger people, and there are some really young people that come, and they're passionate about the music, and it's really something to see. I mean, it's not unusual to see a row of, you know, 15-year-olds, 20-year-olds. It's not that unusual, and so it's been interesting to see how that audience, how the different audiences respond to the music. So they all like the music, or they all love the music, really.
So these are maybe the grandkids of the...
That is correct.
Yeah, that generation.
that's right.
But what is it about folk music that you think kind of transcends age?
Transcends age and generations. I think there's a few things. I think one is that the music is accessible to everybody. And the way that the trio does it, a lot of hard work goes into making it sound easy. And I think that helps. I think that the songs are story songs, essentially. I was watching the American Music Awards, and, you know, I can't knock them because they're doing so well. But I noticed that the music, the dancing is as important to those awards and that genre of music as the actual singing is, whereas in folk music and American music, as we do it, it's all about the music and it's all about the lyrics and the music. It's not about whether, you know, whether we're wearing sequin shirts or have a bunch of dancers around us. There's two different things. So I think that's one of the things that makes it all really interesting.
And I think, too, you know, the acoustics, right? I mean, just a nylon string guitar.
That's right.
It's just something, there's something so pure about that.
Yeah, that's true. And our show is completely acoustic. And you're right. There, when you walk in and you hear an acoustic show, you immediately know you can listen to everything. You can hear in our concert, whether there's 1,000 people or whether there's 4,000 people, you can hear a pin drop between the songs, and you can really feel it. People don't get up in the middle of our songs and go to the bathroom or go get a beer or anything. Everybody stays real still and quiet, which I think is part of the general experience. I don't think that's common that much anymore.
Well, I think, but like you say, with the lyrics, you know, your songs are stories. And, you know, whether it's Tom Dooley or something else, it's that story that catches people's attention.
That's right. I mean, you're right. Tom Dooley's a perfect example. And on a more frivolous and fun, MTA is another, and Where Have All the Flowers Gone. I always acknowledge in Where Have All the Flowers Gone, you know, Pete Seeger, who wrote the song, he was in the U.S. Army in the Pacific during World War II. And one of the things I think is that before he wrote Where Have All the Flowers Gone, he probably... part of it was conceived in his head because he saw the crews coming in from the bombing runs in Japan, and he saw firsthand what war was all about. And that's where I think part of his whole experience of, you know, peace on earth and all that kind of originated in during that period, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's poetry. Right? The lyrics,
definitely,
the words.
Definitely, yes.
And if the younger songwriters today get that, you know, we've got the new alternative rock, up-and-coming stars, you know, Billie Eilish, you know, and to see what she's doing with her brother at age 17. I mean,
yeah, I saw her the other night, and I was trying to equate that in a way. I was trying to equate a lot of it to the Kingston Trio and folk music of the 1950s and 1960s. And in some places, I can see a connection. Other places, the distances seem larger than I would have anticipated. So it's all pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, music evolving and music staying the same.
That is correct.
And that was Mike Marvin of the Kingston Trio, who will be in town for a concert at the Hawaii Theater this Thursday, the 19th. For links, head to our website, and we leave you with a Kingston classic.
When I was 17, when I was 21, it was a very good year. It was a very good year for city girls who lived up the stairs with perfumed hair that came undone. When I was 21,
support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Nico's Pier 38, offering fresh fish and party platters, Nico's Kailua, featuring live music, and Nico's Upstairs, with views of Honolulu Harbor, serving steaks and seafood. Nico'sPier38.com.
We have to go now, but up tomorrow, we sit down with Coralie Mariyoshi as she prepares to step down as head of the Hawaii chapter of the American Red Cross. Do you have a Red Cross story to share? Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them all on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.